It's Noise and Notes. I'm Philip Bailey. State Senator Perry Clark is pushing for the legalization of weed with the Gatewood-Galbraith Medical Marijuana Act. I sat down with a Louisville Democrat to talk about the politics of pot.
The time has come. We're at a tipping point in the United States of America. You know, as many as 74% of the American public believe that medical marijuana should be allowed. About 54%, 56% believe that marijuana itself should be decriminalized. We're at the tipping point. 18 states, plus the District of Columbia, have medical marijuana laws. And even the District of Columbia law had to be signed into effect by Mr. Obama. So, you know, we know this is out there. We're at a tipping point. Virtually every state that surrounds us is currently working on a medical marijuana bill. And, you know, and Kentucky needs to get up on the forefront of this. You know, there's a lot of economic benefits to doing this. And it truly is a medicine. That's what we're really dealing with here. The Federal Drug Food and Drug Administration says that marijuana has no medicinal values. That is their statement. But really, what we're looking at, if that is the statement that they're making to us, why does the United States government hold the patent for medical uses of the cannabis plant? There's a patent number, 663-0507. It is a United States patent number held by the National Institutes of Health for all the medical uses of marijuana.
So what's the resistance to it then? I mean, it seems that proponents have a pretty cogent argument about this. Why have state legislators in some states, some more than others, been resistant to the idea of at least making medical marijuana legal?
I think what you have to look at is the voters. And so you're dealing with a political reality here. And what we have in the United States is over 60 years of lies and propaganda surrounding the medical marijuana plant. Marijuana has been, historically, it's been, we know, 2,900 years of medicinal history. It was the number one, two, and three prescribed drug by doctors until almost 1900. And it works for many, many things. When the petrochemical, pharmacal, petri dish creators of medicine came out, that's really got the marijuana swept away. And that's probably the underlying biggest cause of it at all. There's lots of reasons, and there's so many nuances. And this thing is a Hydra monster on why it was made illegal.
I've seen polling that shows that the majority of people do sort of favor legalization on some level, whether of marijuana altogether or medical marijuana. But just because the people believe something, and when it gets into the machine of government, is this likely to go anywhere in Frankfurt? I mean, it didn't before. Do you think this go around, this round?
Here's the only thing that makes it likely, Philip, is the people. And the people have the power of the democracy. And if people would educate themselves, and we're calling this Education Summer, and we're asking people to look at the data that is available.
I want to ask you a personal question, though.
Yes.
Do you smoke marijuana?
That's not a very good question. That is an absolute distraction. I will tell you I'm a 70s child. I'm a veteran that they put in all the Oriental
countries in the 1970s. You named the act after Gatewood Galbraith.
Yes, I did.
And Gatewood was very open and honest about it.
When
I interviewed him, he said, yes, I do. I have seen no problem with that. I do when I need to, and I don't when I don't need to.
He was an asthma for a child. I do not in general. My doctor has recommended medical marijuana for me. I have chronic back pain. I'm on a standing prescription for about 8 hydrocortisone a day, hydrocortisone and 6 Flexeril. Could you imagine anyone taking that much medication? I would be pretty much basically a zombie. So no, I kind of live with my pain. I don't like the illegality of it. I cannot get it from medicine. I have been known to smoke marijuana. I'm not afraid of marijuana. It's a whole lot less problems involved with marijuana than alcohol. There's no bad side effects. The government has studied that, and we've got some great studies of that by the National Institute of Health. There's very little that can damage you with smoking some marijuana.
You sort of see it in the same way that people have compared it to prohibition. Compared to alcohol.
That's exactly what it is. And if you look at the history of prohibition, you look at the history of alcohol, it's really interesting because Henry Ford intended for Fords to be run out of hemp oil. He intended to, and he made plastic hemp. He thought you could almost grow a car instead of being dependent on the oil and everything. And he thought you would run that out of it. But you had to take the hemp seed and to make basically an ethanol out of it, which is an alcohol. And the Rockefellers, who wanted cars to be run out of oil, gave over $4 million to the Temperance League. And they gave it to the churches to lie to the people and to sweep prohibition in. Prohibition was an absolute mess in the United States. The residual went on and on. Prohibition of a seed, a God-given natural seed that you put in the ground and you grow it for food, you grow it for fiber, you grow it for fuel, you grow it for medicine, is it's an anathema that that's prohibited. It's an anathema to everything this country is about.
Now, what
it's
about those who
freedom,
argue—
to liberty, to compassion, to justice?
Because I know that there's already been some pushback.
There's going to be lots of arguments.
When we first posted up your story,
sure,
we got some pushback from some young Republicans in the city of Louisville,
uh-huh,
who argued that, you know, this is disgraceful, I guess, to have an illegal drug being pushed by a state legislator. There are some, it's still some violence associated
that's
with—
That's a ridiculous
distraction. But there's still some violence associated with the drug trade. But I guess what you're saying is that the same thing with alcohol, if we make it legal, why not just push for legalization, period?
That's actually what needs to be happening. I think that's inevitable, and that's absolutely correct. I think that's where you need to go, is free the whole seed for all of its many uses. I think you'll find, as we liberalize in all the best senses of the word, our marijuana laws and actually our drug laws. If you look at what happened in Portugal, and most people don't understand the Portugal model, they're a Christian, conservative nation, Catholic nation. They had one of the worst drug problems in the world. What they did, they didn't know what to do finally, and they had the same kind of war on drugs we have, useless, waste of money, incarcerate everybody, and they decriminalized all drugs. And I just said all drugs. And for every indicator you could look at that you wanted to see a positive effect on, they had a positive effect on. Adult drug use, down. Teenage drug use, down. Prison population, down. Crime, down. A lot of the problems with our prohibition, and it's the same with the alcohol prohibition, is you allow all the money on the black market. You know, you allow that to come to the service, let it be done, put a taxation policy into it. And it's not just about people that want to smoke weed or people that, under necessity and under their own conscience, want to do medical marijuana for medicinal and healing
properties.
I'm
sure you were aware probably earlier this year, maybe you did, but earlier this year, a constituent contacted Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell,
mm-hmm,
about legalizing marijuana. And the senator said, told the constituent in a February 14th letter that he has serious concerns about legalizing marijuana for medical purposes. And he's also troubled by the fact that many legalization proposals would make marijuana available to the public without following the scientific processes. And he also warned that marijuana leads to death.
Lord have mercy. That is the biggest bunch of trite. There is not one recorded death from marijuana in the history of mankind.
Let me quote him specifically. In his letter, he says, quote, "The detrimental effects of drugs have been well documented. Short-term memory loss, loss of core motor functions, heightened risk of lung disease, and even death." So you disagree with that?
Yes, that is all a lie, and I have the documentations and the research study that proved none of that is true. That is the old fear that we use to keep people under control and make them have to think very good. During the education summer, we're going to expose all these documents. We have these studies that were done by NIH, and they did them in several different nations on the impairment of medical marijuana, marijuana. Not medical marijuana, just the regular smoking of marijuana for recreational uses and enjoyment. They found no impairment, no impairment in brain function, no lung conditions. There's never been an issue of one person ever contracting cancer, lung cancer, from marijuana. These are not facts. These are opinions and fear tactics. There is so much evidence that refutes everything the senator says.
Are you at all worried about, I mean, you're pretty bold. I mean, you're very passionate about this issue, obviously.
And lots of issues, and we've talked about other issues.
Exactly.
And I don't back up on them either.
But on this, you're doing this in the midst of an election year.
Yes, and that had nothing to do with it, honestly.
Clearly. I mean, because some people would say that this would be certainly something that an incumbent politician wouldn't want to bring up.
Wouldn't want to. And all of my so-called handlers and campaign people are, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? The time has come. We're at the tipping point. And Kentucky needs to get on the point of this spear. We need to part. We need to benefit from this. You know, we fight over hundreds of millions of dollars, and I'm telling you, a clear policy of decriminalization of marijuana and medical marijuana, you're gonna reduce your prison population, you're gonna save money, you're gonna not break up your families, which you do with the policy that we have. It's a terrible thing. You know, we had a good friend, MS sufferer, and through a weird fluke, the police caught him growing some marijuana. And they came and took his children away. Now, that's barbaric for someone to have MS, and they do medical marijuana, no one knows. No one knows but them. None of their neighbors know. Nobody knows. And it was really fluke that they even found it because they were looking for a bank robber's bag he threw out, and they got close to his house and they found weed. That's barbaric and wrong-headed. We need to change these laws. It's time.
Senator Perry Clark, keeping the memory of Gatewood Galbraith alive. Senator, thank you for joining us.
God bless Gatewood. Thank you, Philip.
It's been 4 years since the death of the outspoken and controversial Reverend Lewis Coleman. I talked with columnist Miriam Williams, fairness leader Jason Gardner, and social justice advocate Michael Forbush about his legacy and
the current state
of civil rights.
He was the one that you knew was going to show up regardless of what happened, right? So if something happened in the West, you know Reverend Lewis Coleman was going to be there. He was going to be there, and he was going to speak his mind, and then he was going to take it to the council and speak his mind. And he would always do that. Without him being there, you don't have that out front voice on a constant basis.
Yeah. For me, I think we are missing just that, the presence. There is no go-to person that I think of immediately when I think of a civil rights leader who's really going to represent those causes for the whole city, not just the West.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think there's one thing is clear. There's sort of two Lewis Colemans. There was the Lewis Coleman that people saw on television who sort of had that pulpit, who was able to rally and get all the attention, negative and positive. I mean, many people who loved Lewis Coleman, there were as many people who hated Lewis Coleman.
Yes.
But then there was also these campaigns that people really didn't hear that much about that he did. I think people obviously thought of him as, oh, anytime someone is shot by the police, he's protesting police brutality. But he also had gun buyback programs and many other things that he did locally. But it doesn't seem that there's a lot of fanfare post his, I guess, demise.
I think that Reverend Coleman represented something very important for those people who were of his generation. So he meant something very important to folks from the Kentucky Alliance or Jobs with Justice or those the folks who came from his generation and Ann Braden's generation. I don't think that he means or his legacy, rather his absence, leaves very much to be missed by the younger generation.
Because you know what surprised me? The 2002... State of African American Youth. It was done by the Urban League in conjunction with University of Louisville Pan-African Studies Department. And the one person that young people, and this is back in 2002, that they admired among all the leaders was the Reverend Lewis Coleman.
Right, and that I attended that Saturday Academy session, and it really surprised me when Dr. Hudson said that there really was no one else that came to mind for the youth and no one else who they thought reached out to their generation either. And I think that in a lot of ways is still missing as far as there being one particular person. I think networks have spread out, and there are leaders that we can think of. Obviously, we can think of Atticus Scott. I think of Shamika Parrish Wright. I think of Kalila Collins and people sitting at this table, Jason and Michael. But that to have that one person that they really admired and looked up to for these causes, I think that has been lost in a way.
But because the one thing I think is different with Reverend Coleman, and Michael mentioned this, was that Reverend Coleman could take a punch. Mm-hmm. I mean, he certainly was someone who understood that, listen, if I'm going to take these positions publicly, people are going to criticize me, not only within my community, but outsiders. I mean, he was someone, Jason, who you were critical of, and still, he would see you in the street and it would be okay.
Absolutely.
He would have that public disagreement with you, but it didn't get personal like it does maybe today.
Absolutely. I certainly admire Reverend Coleman in the same way I admire Ann Braden and all those folks who have done the work before I came along as a young adult activist. The problem with having one central figure who represents the movement, or one central figure who's admired, is that there's a monopoly of information, number one. And then second of all, we all put our hopes into this one person.
Mm-hmm. And when that one person dies, then
all hope is lost. And so I do appreciate that you have Kalila, Shamika, these new young activists who are doing works in their community, who are working in coalition. Because the problem, for example, with Reverend Coleman was that although he did wonderful work on a lot of issues, on other issues, he missed the boat. So, for example, when the Fairness Ordinance was being worked on, he was anti-fairness, the Fairness Ordinance, to a large degree, very publicly, in fact, and I criticized them for that. And so, again, how does that ostracize young Black LGBT folks who are working for civil rights when the penultimate civil rights leader isn't in favor of your liberation? So I think that that's a problem. You have one figure in which you let rest all your hopes. If they don't meet you where you are on all the issues, then you kind of, I don't know, then that's where there's a disconnect.
And I think that not only is that problematic, but there is a split in Louisville, especially in the social justice community, with individuals who are our age and individuals who are from Reverend Coleman's generation.
Mm-hmm. And you say, all right, you talk about people 35 and younger or what?
35 and younger. There's no passing of the torch. So as these individuals pass away, we're left without that real, so, okay, come on, let's, you know, sit down and talk about this. Let me show you how we did it. Maybe we can start working toward, you know, something new. So every time something happens, we're there and the older generation show up and there's a kind of ideological clash in how things want to be done.
What about the new crop? I mean, we mentioned some of the people, but I think what do we think about someone like a Christopher 2X?
Awkward silence.
Yeah. Well, let me say this. I think that Christopher 2X is well intentioned. I think that the work that he does, in some instances, is needed. However,
is he a civil rights leader?
He's able to reach certain facets of our community that people simply haven't been able to reach. If I'm being accused of a crime, whether it be murder, assault, when else in the history of Louisville have I come to a community leader to say, come help me turn myself in? If anything, I went to folks and said, help hide me. You know, so the fact that folks call him first to mediate, to negotiate, to all those things, I think that...
So there's a particular set of services that are provided for funerals, perhaps, for vigils, but not necessarily issue-oriented like it was under Coleman, necessarily.
Agreed. When I think of 2X, I think of homicides. And if something
happens...
The
Ghetto Grim Reaper. That's the... I mean, no, really. Like, the idea that... Like,
I wasn't going to say that.
Well, I will. So, someone in the military knows this, or someone who's related to someone in the military, that when you get that knock on the door, that is someone reporting that your loved one died overseas. And I've always said that the last thing a mother in West Louisville wants... is Christopher 2X to knock on their door.
Right.
And that's not saying anything necessarily bad about him, but that's because his association, like Miriam said, we associate him with a certain issue, but not necessarily the issue of like solving the problem, but the service of that problem.
Right. Yeah, he's not a social justice activist in general. He is someone who has, I guess, found his niche and serves a very significant purpose. I think of Yvonne Cano when he was murdered several years ago, and that for his mother, who is a Latino immigrant to this country, and Christopher 2X seemed to be her biggest ally. And had it not been for him, how might she have felt about the entire process? And so I think that he has been something very, very important to a lot of folks.
To get that pulpit focused in on. Now, what we have seen is that some of the old models still exist. I mean, I think the mayor's task force on violence sort of showed that there still is this model of the leader. We go to that particular person who has that most maybe prominent position and involve them. One member of that panel, Reverend Kevin Cosby, senior pastor of St. Stephen's Baptist Church, and also the president of Simmons College of Kentucky, a historically black college here in Louisville, he penned, Jason, an article in the Courier Journal recently called The Black Responsibility. Now, much of it is sort of unoriginal in the sense of, you know, saying, well, it's no longer about racism, it's about personal responsibility in the African-American community. That's something that you hear, at least my time growing up in West Louisville, people talk about all the time anyway. But what did you take from the piece?
I really, really enjoyed much of what he had to say. Although you're right, they weren't original ideas. He did a lot of quoting of Du Bois and Baldwin and other great black thinkers. And so what he's saying is the problem has always been that black leaders have always tended to go towards racism as being the cause of our major problems, right? So you think of Reverend Coleman, you think about racism. You think about protesting racial inequality. You think about protesting affirmative action situations. But I think that what is important is that it has to be, you have to approach our problems from many different angles. So yes, racism will always have an impact on every issue that affects a black person in Louisville. Similarly, it's equally important that we are pursuing education, pursuing business opportunities. So it isn't just about racism anymore. It is about economic empowerment. You know, it is about pursuing education. It's about all those things and not just about racism anymore.
But I guess the point is that both are always going on. I mean, I think, isn't African-American history always this debate about is it self-help or government intervention, when it's always, internally speaking, been both? I don't know anyone, I mean, who has had someone say, oh, go out there, and it's just going to be something about racism holding you back, when people often say, you're going to have to try 10 times harder, or you have to be held personally accountable for what you, the fact that you didn't study. I mean, the idea, it sort of just seems like the Bill Cosby lecture again, where you're reiterating something that Black folks already sort of say and know amongst themselves.
But do we know it? But do we know it? And then do we apply it? So, for example, a Black mother who's on television crying because her son has been murdered or put in jail for murder, did she tell him to pull up his pants when he was sagging? Did she tell him to stop using profanity when he's cussing around grown folk? You know, when he's bringing money in the house and he ain't got no job, and you ask him questions about where it comes from, or are you spending that money? You know, so therein, on a very practical level, is when it comes down to us taking personal responsibility. If I get on a TARC bus and an old Black lady gets on the bus and there's no seats available, do I stand up and give her my seat?
So you're talking about like a certain civic behavior.
I'm talking about on a very personal level. It's about behavior, and it's about our parents and our grandparents holding us accountable and modeling particular behaviors. If your child does not have a GED, you can't live in my house until you get your GED. There are things that parents can do on a very practical level to change behaviors and to model good citizenship, is what I'm saying. As opposed to saying, oh, the man, I understand why you're selling drugs. It's so hard out here for a pimp. No, it ain't. McDonald's is around the corner.
But I have to say that along with that, because what for me what was missing in his piece, he mentions institutional racism, right? But he skims over it like it's the smallest problem. When in Louisville, the Leo had the study that showed that young Black boys are punished more harshly for the same offenses as anybody else.
Now, someone would say, listen, don't even get in trouble in the first place.
Which goes back to my point, exactly. So, you know, sort of like my mother would say, if you already know it's harder here for a Black man,
so it's still the Jackie Robinson rule.
Don't give a person a reason.
Wait, but it's still the Jackie Robinson rule. It's still this idea of, listen, we live in an unequal society. You have to sort of accept that.
So we're going
to
accept.
You have to work harder and be perfect, exactly. But nobody can be perfect. Yeah. And to your point of being on a very practical level, this personal responsibility, most people can do that, but there really are segments of people who just don't know how.
What surprised me, though, about these sort of articles, and as a result of, I guess, the Bill Cosby speeches, there is no synthesis that was developed. It still is the self-responsibility camp and the institutional racism camp. When everyone knows it is sort of a mixture of both,
yeah,
in this country. And no one, of all these thinkers, whether nationally or locally, no one has come up with a synthesis ideology or model for anyone to go on and move on. Jason Gardner, Marion Williams, Michael Forbush, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you for having us.
Noise and Notes on WFPL is produced by me, Philip Bailey, with Joe Durso. For more information, visit WFPL.org.